Hey, so we are holding on Chof Dalet Amud Aleph. We were actually in the middle of a discussion, so we'll go back a couple of lines and start the Tani Rebchiya, 8 lines from the top. Okay, so we were talking about the issue of Roiv versus Korov. Yeah, the Torah tells us that when you go according to the majority, Achragam Mahatis, the Torah also tells us in the case of Egla Arucha that you go according to Korov, whichever is closest. And the question is, what if those two things conflict? We started saying at the beginning of the Sugya that Rav Chanina said in that Roiv and Korov. So we started by saying that Rav Chanina said you go according to Roiv. And then, so we're discussing. So then, yeah. So we're discussing.
Thank you.
So we're discussing about Roiv. We're discussing about Roiv versus Korov. So the last thing we said was that Abaya wanted to bring a proof from a case in Hilchos Nida where we say that if you find blood in the proizder by a woman, whatever the exact definition of proizder is, we discussed briefly yesterday, then even though there's a chance it may have come from the mucker, it may have come from the uterus, in which case she'd become a nida, or it may have come from the aliyah, whatever we define the aliyah as. Right, which then she would be tahor, because then it's just like blood from anywhere else in the body, and we say that she's considered tummy.
Blood from anywhere in the body?
From anywhere else, yes. If a woman has a nosebleed or blood from any other part of her body, she's tahor, it's only from
the aliyah.
Yes, even it's only from the womb. It's only from the womb, from the uterus that makes her tummy. Because then it's dam nidah, or dam zivos, or dam yodos, or what have you. When we learn the sefer nidah, that's the Shem, we'll get into all that in exhaustive detail, but yeah, that's how it is. There's a cause. Yeah, okay. Okay, so we said then that in that case, so you see that we consider her to be tummy because we go according to Roiv, because Roiv blood comes from the mocker. But we said, so the last thing we said that Rava answered, that no, that's different because that's Roiv umasri. There you have, it's sort of like a double Roiv. You have, there's the fact that Roiv, the actual amount of blood, the actual volume of blood is greater from the rechem, is greater from the uterus than it is from the aliyah.
But
second of all,
issue.
Therefore, if you find a particular drop of blood, it's more likely to have come from there. But second of all, on top of that, you have also matzi, the fact that it's more often that it comes from the rechem. Okay, well, he says that those two things together. Okay, so Ditani Rabchia. Now, this Ditani Rabchia, I mean, on the face of it, Ditani Rabchia would be that we're bringing a proof to what Rava is saying. Tosfos discusses that a little bit, because not necessarily is what Rabchia saying going to be a proof for this idea of Roiv Umotsu. You could just as well say that it shows that when there's one Roiv by itself, as Rav Chanina said, it's enough. So Tosfos discusses the possibilities. Maybe the Ditani Rabchia is referring back to Abaya, that how does Abaya prove from that we're not just talking about a sophist, that we're talking about something which is considered a Vadai. Or we could say that the Gemara is just, maybe it's just Tony Rabchia. Maybe it's a separate statement. Having mentioned Abaya versus Rava, we're explaining, by the way, what does Rabchia say about this?
I got it.
The Tony Rabchia would mean that we're going to be bringing a proof for what Rava is saying from the following Braise. But the Braise itself doesn't say anything about Roiv and Motsui. So how is it a proof to Rava? So one angle that Tosfos talks about is maybe it's actually referring back to what Abaya is saying. Abaya is arguing that Sfeika Tome, and how do we know that when we say Sopik Tome means more than just Sopik, we mean we consider it like a Vadai, because we see it from Rabchia's Braise. So Tani Rabchia, Dama Nimsa B'Prozder, if the woman finds blood in the Prozder, Chayavin Olav Al B'Yismikdash, she would be at that point Chayav for a Korban if she came into the B'Yismikdash afterwards. We would not say it's a Sopik, and if it was a Sopik, she wouldn't bring a Korban, because you generally don't bring a Korban on a Sopik. We consider it a Vadai to that extent. A Vadai, in other words, that came from the uterus, and therefore that she's Tomei. V'Sofin Olav Al-Truma, and we burn Truma if she touched it again. We don't say that it's a Sopik, and therefore Tolin, we should let the Truma be in abeyance, not sure what to do with it. No, we actually burn it. So we see it's not just a Sopik, we see it's a Vadak.
According to Rabchia.
Well, we don't have anybody who argues it, Rabchia. In fact, V'Omad Rava, and Rava himself says, Shmamina min Rabchia plus. We can learn three dinim from the statement of Rabchia. Shmamina roiv v'korav halachacha roiv. Number one, we can see that when you have roiv versus korav, then you go according to the roiv. Now, what happened to Motsi? What happened?
That's what
Gemara itself is going to ask that in a minute. Hold on. Right, so that's another explanation of what the Gemara means over here, that the Gemara is bringing this braise of Rabchia and Rava's explanation about it to point out, not so much in connection with the discussion between Abaya, well, sort of, but to point out a contradiction between two statements of Rava himself. He's arguing to Abaya it's different Roiv or Motsui, but you see from his explanation of his braise that he doesn't care about Motsui.
That's the second.
So that's the second. So that's number one. Shmamina ruba daraisa. Number two, Rava says, you see from this braisa that to go according to the roiv is a thing daraisa. Otherwise, again, she couldn't bring a korban because it would be a suffix, and he wouldn't bring truma because it would be a suffix. So we're saying this concept of roiv is daraisa. The third thing we can learn from that is that we do have to accept also Reb Zera's statement about how Roiv works. Namely like this. What's a classic case of Roiv in Shas? We learned back in Ksubas, is for example, Dalsus Medina Na'ulis literally means the gates of the city are locked. Meaning like this. Dalsus Medina, the gate. It's a mistake. It's supposed to be above. If yours is pointed with a yod, then
it looks like pretty much.
It's above. Dalsus Medina Na'ulis means the gates of the city are locked. It means like this. The classic case, one of the classic cases when we talk about Roiv and Halacha, is a case that we learned about in Ksubas called Teisha Hanurias Merchus Psar Shchota. Or actually the other way around. Teisha Hanurias Merchus Psar Shchota. You have nine stores in town that sell kosher meat, one that sells tshefer meat. If you find a package of meat in the street and you're not sure, you have no way of knowing which of the 10 stores it came from, you can go, according to Roiv, and assume that it's kosher meat. Because now 90% chance that it is. The Halacha allows you to do that. That's Roiv. Now,
of course, if you have three stores, you could also go.
Yeah. Now, there's a
three grocer and
whatever. As long as they have a majority. As long as they have a majority, yeah. As long as it's two, yeah, 2-1 would also
be 2-1.
Yeah. Now, the Gemara there distinguishes between whether it's kavua. If you went into one of the stores and bought, then we have to say it's a 50-50 chance you went into the Tereza store. So that wouldn't work. But we're talking about where it's not kavua. You found it in the street. Now, you could argue that maybe in that case, maybe that concept only works if the surrounding area is also mostly Jews, and therefore not only you have within the city itself most of the butcher shops are Jews, but in the surrounding area, the meat that's going to be brought into the city from the outside world is more likely to be from a kosher place. Maybe you could argue only in that case. Reb Zera comes and tells us, no, even if the gates of the city are locked, there is no way for any other meat to be brought in from the outside. We're strictly going based on the preponderance of stores in the city. Nevertheless, that's enough for us to say that this package of meat is kosher.
As opposed to if they were not locked?
In other words, Reb Zera is saying if they weren't locked and the majority and the surrounding area was mostly Jews, for sure it would be allowed because you have not just you're considering the fact that 90% of the stores in town are sell kosher meat, but also that the surrounding area, most meat that's brought into the city is also kosher. But here we're saying even if it's not that, even if you're strictly going based on what's in the city, nevertheless you can still go according to the Roiv. How do we
think otherwise?
Because you would think maybe you need two Roivs. Maybe you need, for certain cases in Halacha, we do require, back in Ksubas over there, we learned that for certain purposes, you do need two roivs. In the case of a woman who had relations, that we can prove from this Braisa that you don't need two roivs in this case.
Because
we, based on what Reb Zera said. How do we see that? That's the point. We can see from this Braisa that Reb Zera is correct. Because after all, the case of a woman finding blood in the proizder is the equivalent of the gates of the city being locked. Obviously, you don't have blood that's coming from anywhere outside her body. Necessarily, it came from somewhere in her body. And yet, we still say, we go according to the Roiv, that Roiv Jomim Minam Makar.
Could come from two different places.
It could come from two different places in her body, but that's the point. That's the equivalent of the piece of the package of meat may have come from a kosher store or a tereza store,
right.
But it can't have come from anywhere else in the world. It came from either the cheder or the aliyah.
Right.
So therefore, we're still saying you go according to the Roiv. So the question is, didn't Rava himself before say that only when it's Roiv and Matsuri do we say that nobody argues? How can he say you prove from this Braita that Roiv itself is enough? The answer is, Rava changed his mind after that. He realized that actually, no, Matsuri is not really such a key factor. Roiv by itself is enough, and we see from this Braita that's the case, and therefore, yes, we approve of Chanina's point. That Roiv versus Korov, you go according to Roiv, even if it's not Matsuri.
It doesn't have to be
Matsuri. As long as it's a Roiv, as long as the preponderance,
the majority.
As long as the majority, as long as the actual
not
volume,
the
not the frequency, but rather the actual volume, yeah.
Not the actual volume, I mean.
Yeah, the actual volume of blood from the Makar is greater than it is from the Aliyah.
Roiv is about quantity, in
other
words?
Yeah, by quantity, yeah. Okay. It's Mar. So now we have a related discussion on that. If you have a barrel of wine floating in the river, well, it might be kosher wine, but it might be yain nesach. Amar Rav, Nimsis Keneged Ir Shirobi Yisrael Motor. If you find it in a part of the river opposite a Jewish city, then it's Motor. Keneged Ir Shirobi Nachrim, a city that's majority Jews, that is, then it's Motor to drink. Keneged Ir Shirobi Nachrim Asira. If you find it in a part of the river near a city that's mostly Goyim, then it's also, because you have to be concerned. It's Yain Nesach. There's a case of Korev. Or Shmuel Amar, where Shmuel says, I feel the Nimsis Keneged Ir Shirobi Yisrael Asira. Even if you find it in a part of the river near a Jewish city, it's also Aser. Emor mehai dekira asoi mehai mihi dekira, whatever. It may have come from much further upstream. It may have come from high dekira, ihi dekira, the name of a place. We learned in Ksubas, which was upstream on the Pros River, on the Euphrates River, which that city was majority goy. So yes, you're finding it downstream by Sura or Naharda or what have you. Maybe it came from 100 miles upstream, and then it came from a city of goy. Okay. So the question is, should we say then that Rav and Shmuel are arguing whether we accept Rav Chanina's principle? Maybe we would say that Rav would not hold like Rav Chanina. Therefore, he would say that even that you go according to Karov, it's near a Goyish city. Therefore, it's near a Jewish city. Therefore, it's Mutter. And therefore, that's enough. Shmuel would go according to Rav, and Shmuel would say the majority of people who live along the entire Pros River are goyim, and therefore you have to go according to that.
So that's the this.
But that, if we say that,
but that's
where
it
goes against. So we go. But that, no, it goes with what we say.
No, it, but we would. In other words, should we say that this that Rav Chanina is saying is not universally agreed? That's what we're asking. This that Rav Chanina is saying that when you have Roy versus Karev, you go according to Roy, maybe that's not universally agreed.
Right.
So maybe
Shmuel
would hold of it. Rav wouldn't. And when it comes to Isser Veheter, the halacha is usually like Rav. Yeah.
Like Rav.
Usually in Isser Veheter, the halacha is usually like Rav. In this case, it is.
Shmuel is what
says. Is by Dinimah, I think. The answer is no. The answer is Loi. The Kulam is Lo Rav Chanina. No, everybody would in fact agree with Rav Chanina. B'hocha miflegi. Rather, though, the underlying machlokas over here is as follows. The they're not arguing on the principle of Roiv and Karev. They're arguing about the practicalities. The practicalities of this particular case.
So they both agree with Roiv.
Yes, they both agree with Roiv, yes. However, like this. The Marsavar, however, Rav figures like this. The reason why it should be Mutter, why are we not concerned it came all the way from Ihi Dekira? The Im Isid, Im Hai Dekira, also, if you're going to think that it came all the way from upstream, all the way from Hai Dekira, Akuli Upshuri, have a Matlila. Meanwhile, between Hai Dekira and here, there's all kinds of places where there's rapids, there's whirlpools in the river, whatever. So that inevitably, the barrel would have sank at some point, would have gotten caught in the rocks or whatever. There's no way it would have floated all the way from Ihi Dekira down to here that we should have to be worried.
There was really rapids in that area.
I guess so. I don't know. Rashi says, Akuli means Shamaimis Akun, Miss Gaugalin, Kagaugav Makam Echad, that there's like whirlpools, turbulence, yeah. Well, Pshuri also means Pshuri Rashi says it's places where snow melts into the river, and therefore like you have stagnant parts of the river over there. So either it would have gotten drowned in one of the whirlpools, or it would have gotten into one of those stagnant areas and there and would have stayed there, it would have gotten stuck there among the rocks or whatever. Well, Mar Sava, where's Shmuel holds? Harifa Denara, not a Vasari. No, because it's possible that it was dropped off in the middle of the river, in the main current of the river, and therefore it managed to float down intact all the way to the Druid. So it's not a matter of principle, it's just a matter of the practicality. Is it conceivably possible for a barrel of wine to make it all the way from Hai Dekira all the way to the Druid? So a case in this, a related case, Ahu Chatzba de Chamber de Shtakach Pardesa de Arla. One time they found a barrel of wine in a...
What would be the description of the roiv here?
So the roiv would be the fact that most people who live along the river are goyim. If conceivably it could have come from Ihi Dekira, from Hai Dekira, or wherever upstream, then the preponderance would tell us that it's goyim. But Karoiv, he found it physically close to a Jewish city. Okay. They once found a barrel of wine in a vineyard where the grapevines were Arla. Now, if we're going to assume, if there's reason to be concerned that this barrel of wine may have been made from the grapes from this vineyard, it would be also. It would be also Bana, in fact. However, Shaya Ravina. However, Ravina was master them to drink this wine. We're not worried. Now this barrel was hidden over there in the vineyard. We're not worried that the person who made this wine may have stolen grapes from this vineyard and turned them into wine and then hid the barrel over there. Well, that's the question. Lema Mishim Desavalokha. Does that necessarily mean that that Ravina accepts Rav Chanina's principle, and therefore we would say again that you go according to Rav, and most vineyards in that area are not kosher, they're not Arla, even though Kora, even though it's physically closer in the vineyard over here. The answer is no. Shiny Hossam, di Mignav Mino, Asnui Begaboy Lemathni. No, again, it's practicality, because in this case, if they'd stolen the wine from this very vineyard, they wouldn't have hit it right there in the vineyard. Because people who are pressing the grapes may find it.
That's the last place you're going to
hide. Yes. However, Vahani Mili Chamra, however, that only applies if you found a barrel of wine. Aval Invi, but if you found grapes, Matni, then they might very well hide them over there. Then there is, not so much because they're small, the Taz explains in Yerodea, the reason is because, in Alokas Orla, the reason is because if it's a barrel of wine, it had to have been pressed at the time of the wine pressing. There were a lot of people there in the vineyard. Grapes may well have been stolen when there's next to nobody around there. And hidden away right there in the vineyard. Not necessarily will anyone have noticed. But therefore,
you can't steal it when there's people and when there's no people.
But wine of necessity, there are going to be people there, because winemaking is a big process and it involves a lot of people.
Where is Hilchos Orla?
In Yodea.
In the end.
No, not in the end. In the middle, in the Reish Tzadik.
Yeah. That to me is the
end. Oh, okay. It goes all the way to Talk. Give more, but okay.
You're right.
Yeah. Okay.
And...
yeah. Okay. Anyway. But yeah. So therefore, there is, by the way, actually, now we're saying that they might hide grapes over there. There is actually the different Rishonim discussed, does that indeed mean, if we accept the Chanina's principle, does that mean we would say the grapes, in fact, are Orla and are Osir? Or maybe not. Maybe even in that case, we would say the fact of the matter is Rav grapes in the world are not Orla. In other words, would we go according to the Rav of grapes? Would we go according to the local area? Or would we go according to Rav grapes from other areas? Tosis points out another detail as well. Most of the world is goyim. Why don't we assume this barrel of wine is Yad Nesach on that ground alone? So Tosis gives an interesting answer based on a Gemara in Avodah Zarah that says Roiv Ganvi Yisrael. At those times, apparently, the sociological reality was that most Ganovim are Jews. Therefore, the chances are that this barrel was stolen by Jews. There are different other Rishonim give different others, and therefore it would be Mutter. Different other Rishonim answer, not so much that, but more talking about that it was in a Jewish area. So therefore, most of the people in the area are, in fact, Jews.
So Rav Ganavi...
Rav Ganvi Yisrael, which is not the same thing, by the way, as saying Rav Yisrael Ganvi.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. It's a Gemara in Avodah Zarah. We'll learn it later.
No, but the amount of Jews in the world is so small that...
We don't mean Rav Ganvi Yisrael in the entire world. In that area, that's him. In areas where Jews live, the Gemara says that Rav Ganvi Yisrael, the most gun of him, and in those areas, would you?
Where,
in Bubble? In Bubble, I guess, yeah. Maybe in Israel also, I don't know. Yeah.
That's a very...
But we're not saying most Jews are gun of him. We're saying most gun of him were Jews. Jews have the brains to be gun of him.
Well, Jews don't believe in the Goyish laws. Like, don't steal.
Yeah, come on. All right, onwards. Okay, another case. Hanu Ziki Decham... Okay, one more thing, by the way, that Rishonim point out. Why don't we say that maybe, okay, somebody was traveling by over here with a barrel of wine and dropped it over here. The answer is people don't travel, the Rabbeinu Yonah says, people don't travel with barrels of wine. They're going to travel, as we'll see in the next case in the Gemara, they travel with bags of wine. A barrel is too heavy, too bulky, to bottle. Another case. Hanu ziki d'chamra d'ishtachan be'kufoi. There were bags of wine, skin bags of wine, that were found among the vines in a Jewish vineyard. That's how Rashi learns. Tosis explains that Beit Kufoi is the name of the place. Anyway, Sharanahu Rava. Rava said that these bags of wine are mutter. Now, Lema Loisavol Adar Rav Chanina. Does that mean that he doesn't hold of Rav Chanina? Again, here you have a case. Fine, the local people are mostly Jews, but Ruba Dalma is goyim. Shouldn't have to go according to that. Say that's also. And here there is a real possibility that came from travelers, because travelers would typically use bags. The answer is shiny hosom. It's different in this case. Because in this area, most of the people who, like this, when you would make your wine originally, you put it into large barrels, that pourre, whatever. Afterwards, though, for selling, you would put it into, you pour it from there into smaller bags, which then could be sold to travelers. So most of the people, shvuchai means the people who have the job of pouring from the barrels into the bags are mostly Jews. Therefore, the chances are that this is the Jews aren't allowed to work with the Yain Netzach. Therefore, the chances are that this bag of wine is kosher. The hani milah b'rabravi. However, though, that only applies to large bags because those aren't the kind that are likely to be carried by travelers. Aval zutri, the smaller bags, they may well have fallen from a passerby, and the passerby, most people in the world are goyim. Then you would have to say it's also. The ikar ravravi b'hadayu. However, if there's a mixture of big and small ones, then it's all allowed. Because given that travelers don't usually carry large ones, it's more logical to assume that they all came from one buyer. And what he did is he had them loaded on his donkey. Now, when we say that travelers don't carry large bags of wine, we mean travelers on foot. But if you're traveling with a donkey and you're carrying large amounts of wine from one place to another, you can use large bags, but then you'll use smaller bags to even out the load. If you have a large bag on one side, you'll put a few smaller bags on the other side. Therefore, the large and the small bags, the pashtus, go together, and therefore they all presumably came from the same person. But whereas if you only found small bags, it could have well been that just people who are passers-by on foot may have dropped them, and most passers-by in the world are goyim, and then it would be also.
So when you find a large one and a small one,
then it's mutter.
Then it's mutter because it comes from...
Provided, we said, that the shvuchai, that the people who deal with pouring the wine into bags are Jews, yes.
Because when you have a large bag and a small bag...
Then that's more likely to have been the kind of thing that was on a donkey, yes.
And that's why we say it's moisture.
Well, then, in other words, then it's not... Then we're not so worried about... Then we're saying that...
You've been going...
Actually, Rabbeinu Gershom actually understands this last part differently. That if we faket ababrura habimanchi would be a reason to say that all of it is osir, because it's more likely that some person was passing by with a donkey, that some guy was passing by with a donkey and had big ones and small ones. Okay, because the Gemara doesn't say it's mutter. The Gemara just says, Emu, you could say, Ba'avruri Habamanchi, that they were all put together to even it out. So according to Rashi, we're talking about this is not the kind of thing, that it's more likely that some local person bought local wine over here and was transporting it on his donkey or whatever, and now you found it. Being Jewish, again, because we're talking in a largely Jewish area. But according to Rabbeinu Gershom, on the contrary, it could equally well have been from a long-distance traveler who might well have been a Jew. I don't know. If you ever find a bag of wine, then we'll figure it out then. Yeah. I mean, practically speaking, we don't live in majority Jewish areas anyway, so it's not, you know.
So the halacha goes not by like Rashi, but by...
It would mean, as a practical matter, if we live in an area that's mostly goyim, of course you have to go according to goyim. Yeah, well, if you were talking in the Gemara, we're talking about an area that's mostly Jews.
Yeah.
Onward. Mishnah says, Marchikin esa'ilin min ha'ir etrim b'chomesh amma. You have to keep away trees from the city 25 amas. The Gemara is going to explain that the reason is in order to make the city more beautiful. There's an open area around it. Which, by the way, some of Mepharshim explain that this concept only applies in Eretz Yisrael. If it's a carob tree or a shikma tree, which have a lot of branches, then you need it 50 amas away. Abba Shol says, in general, not just a chorov or a shikma, any non-fruit-bearing tree, Rashi says it's a gnai for the city. It's not as beautiful for the city. Mela, a fruit tree, at least you have the benefit of the fruit, but a non-fruit bearing tree, any one of those has to be at least 50 amas away.
Between 25 and 50.
The ima ir kodma, continues the Mishnah, if the city was there first and later on you planted your tree, you're obligated to chop it down and the city is not obligated to pay you for it. But if the tree was there first, you still need to chop it down, but then the owner of the city has to pay you for it. Suffolk Zekodim or Suffolk Zekodim, if you have a Suffolk, which one came first? Kotzitz Vein and Oisin Damim, then you have to chop it down and they're not obligated to pay you, for reasons which we'll talk about in the Gemara. The Gemara says, my time, what's the reason for this 25 or 50 Amma thing? Amma Ula Mishim Noyeh Yehir. So Ula says the reason is for the city to be beautiful. Question is, but typically, why do we need that? Don't we have a different din that? Don't we have a different din that's relevant to this that we should say for a different reason you can't have it over there? The ein osrin soder migrash for a migrash soder. The Torah tells us by the Ori Miklot. By the Ori Halavim, that each of them had a migrash around them of 1,000 amos, and then there were fields and vineyards. There's different opinions in a couple of places in the Gemara. What exactly was it? 1,000? There's also a machlokas among the Rishonim. Is it 1,000 migrash and then 2,000 of fields? Is it 1,000 of migrash and 1,000 of fields? Whatever it is, there's a migrash is an open area. Yeah, an open area around the city. And we learn that ein oisin sodra migrash or a migrash sodra. You're not allowed to take the migrash and turn it into fields. You're not allowed to take the fields and turn them into a migrash. So therefore, not a contradiction. The point is, having trees over there amounts to making it a sodder. Right. So of course you can't. Yeah.
So
that's the question. Why does the Mishnah need to tell us, and why does Ula need to tell us that you can't have trees in those 25 yamas, Mishum Noya here? You anyway can't have trees in that area because that would be turning the Migrash into something else other than a Migrash. And the Migrash has to be a completely open area. 1,000 amas. Yeah.
1,000 amas, so how can we
say that? That's a separate issue. But first we're dealing with within 25 amas, it's truly within 1,000. Yeah. The answer is Lloyd Tzricha. Okay, but we only need to say it. Rabbi Eliezer. Dorma Oysen Sadr Migr from Migrash Sadr. Rabbi Eliezer says only by the Ore Halavim does that. The Chachamim hold that it applies in general to cities in Israel. Any city that has a Migrash and has Sadrates around it, you're not allowed to turn one into the other. But whereas Rabbi Elazar disagrees and says that only applies to the Ore Halavim.
That you can't take
the Migrash and turn it into fields or vice versa. But any other city, now it's Israel, sure, according to Rabbi Elazar, you could. So therefore, Hacha Mishim Noya Heir Lo Yavdin. Nevertheless, even Rabbi Elazar would agree that in order to beautify the city, you still can't have trees within 25 or 50 amas of the city. Ula Rabbanan Nami, and furthermore, we can talk about even according to the Rabbanan, we say that you're not allowed to take the Migrash and turn it into fields. Hanim Yisroyim, you could argue that maybe even our Mishnah could even work according to the Chachamim.
There were gardens, the Migrash?
Migrash is an empty area. It's an open area. Its purpose is to make the city look beautiful.
So that's what I'm asking. How does it make it nice?
Because, you have the built-up... No, it's not. The gardens and fields and whatever are further out. This is an open area around the city just to improve the appearance of it.
I have to only picture it was grass.
It may well have had grass, but it wasn't a cultivated area. Fine. Even according to the Rabbanan, they say as a general rule, with any city in Eretz Yisrael, you're not allowed to take the Migrash and turn it into fields, or vice versa. However, we could still say that Rabbanan would say that only applies to planting seeds, to planting fields over there. Even the Rabbanan might agree that within that 1,000 Amma Migrash, you are allowed to plant trees. But not within 25 or 50 amos of the city, as our Mishnah is saying. So our Mishnah can still work, and Ula's explanation can still work according to the Chachamim. So here we're saying, for beautifying the city, you want to keep the trees 25 amos away, or with certain kinds of trees, 50 amos. But outside of that, you want to plant trees in the Migrash, go right ahead. The Chachamim wouldn't have a problem with that. They would just have a problem making it into a field of planted seeds. There is, by the way, as far as this business of Einos and Sodor Migrash or Migrash Sodor, Shem Shem Afal Hirsch has an interesting take on it in Parshas Bahar, which is where these dinim are. He says the idea behind it is the Torah does not really want that you're going to have, that the Torah does not really want that you, first, I mean, you can't take the field and turn them into a Migrash because you need the fields for cultivation. People need to grow crops. You also don't want to have that these cities are going to be enlarged into the Migrash. There's also a dinim where they can't turn the Migrash into part of the city because if the city is getting that large, found a new city. The ideal is that you should live in small towns that are more closely related to the farming around them, rather than that you're living in big cities where you have nothing to do really with the cultivation of the soil or whatever. The Torah's ideal is that people are living in small towns where they and farming. That's how he explains it.
So we don't really go by that anymore.
Well, most of us are not farmers, but most of us don't live in Eretz Yisrael.
But also, can't you say that if you go too close, you're going to destroy the walls of the city?
It's talking even about an unwalled city. Where do you find that there's any? Where do you see this kind of concept that there's a distinction between a field planted with seeds versus trees? Titania, we know this based on a braisa that talks about an eruvin. If you have karpif, a karpif is an enclosed area. Yosim beis sosayim, if it is now the din is like this: a karpif If it's less than base safayim, which is the size of the chotah of the Mishkan, 5,000 square amas, then you're allowed to carry in it, regardless 5, what...
5,000 square amas?
5,000 square amas, you're talking about, if it was a square, it would be 70 amas on a side, which is about 110 feet or so. So a square, 110 feet on a side, if it's roughly. If it's smaller than that, smaller, therefore, than the courtyard of the Mishkan, you're allowed to carry in it because it's enclosed. If it's larger than that, it depends what it was enclosed for. Is it hookah from Dira? Was it enclosed for purposes of using, of being used as a living area? Not necessarily that there has to be a house there, per se, but for example, you have it enclosed as a backyard or whatever. You know, it's something that you're using. It's not just a salmon open area. It's not just an open area for storage or whatever. Then you're allowed to carry in it, but if not, then not, if it's larger than Beis Sosayim. So suppose you have a kaifrif, Yosim Beis Sosayim, Shehukaf Ladira, which was enclosed for purposes of using it for living purposes, which then you're allowed to carry in it. However, Nizra Ruboy, however, if then you take most of that kaifrif and plant it with seeds.
We learned that in Eruv.
We learned that in Eruv, years back, yeah. Hareu Kagina, now it's considered like a garden, but also, and now it becomes also to carry in it because now it's not considered Ladira anymore. So then, Nita Ruboy, however, if you planted most of it with trees, the trees don't prevent it from being considered a kaifrif. Hareu kachotzer, then it's like a chotzer, because people commonly use trees to sit under and relax or whatever, unlike a planted area with seeds where people don't walk over it. No, it is enclosed. The area is enclosed, but in that enclosed area, you plant the trees.
Right.
So therefore, we're saying the trees don't prevent it from being considered a kaifrif shehukaf ladira.
Right, exactly.
Exactly. Right. But it's still enclosed, yeah. And therefore you're allowed to continue carrying it. So we see there's an example where there's a distinction between planting seeds in the ground versus planting trees.
So in this carpet, the area that has trees
is still, the whole area
is enclosed?
By definition, a carpet is enclosed.
Right.
Yes. So therefore we're saying if you were to plant most of that, you're no longer allowed to carry even in the unplanted areas. So the whole enclosed area is greater than Beis Sosayim. And now, by planting most of it with seeds, with crops or whatever, you've now turned it into something other than a kaifrif. You've now turned it into a gina, into a garden.
And therefore?
Therefore, it's also to carry, even in the remaining part, because the whole thing is greater than Beis Sosayim, and it's not hookah flabira. It's not enclosed for the purposes of living space anymore. But if you have trees, then...
Anyway.
What do you mean? If it's enclosed, then yes, you can. Shehukah flabira. We will. Shehukah Fladira. It was enclosed for
said it's Hukah Fladira.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, okay. So that's
but now you changed
it wasn't, by the way.
I meant that it was. Yeah. No, it was Hukah Fladira.
It was
Hukah Fladira. But now you went and planted the majority of it. Now it's not Hukah Fladira anymore.
Right.
That's what I was saying. Now it's considered that it's not Hukah Fladira anymore because now it's not, now most of it is an area where you're not gonna walk around. As opposed to
enclosed,
a street.
It's enclosed.
Doesn't matter. It's greater than Beis Sosayim, and it's not Hukah Fladira anymore. Therefore, it's also. Whereas trees don't prevent that, because trees are still, you would still continue to use it as for the same purposes as before. You would relax in the shade of the trees.
So, by being enclosed, you mean less than a Beis Sosayim?
No, more than a Beis Sosayim. The area that's enclosed is greater than a Beis Sosayim.
Right.
It's the area of three saw.
Right.
If you were to now plant two saw of that area, you're not even allowed to carry in the remaining one saw because the entire enclosure is three saw and it's not Hukaf Ladira anymore because the majority of it is not Ladira. As opposed to if you plant a tree, but not Ladira. But if you plant trees in it, then you're allowed to continue carrying. So therefore
your house is still inside of it. But
it doesn't matter. No, it doesn't have to be that your house. No, if your house was inside of it, it wouldn't matter, I don't think. No, if we're talking about your house is not inside of it. It's behind your house, let's say, or next to your house.
But it's still Hukaf Ladira because your house...
Because the fact that there are trees in it doesn't prevent it from being used Ladira. Yeah, it doesn't prevent it from being used for Ladira purposes.
Hukaf Ladira means that it's either connected to the back of your house or your house inside of it.
Okay. Fine, but the point is, once it's planted, then you're not going to use it Ladira anymore. You're
right.
Not going to use
it so as essentially it's available for
yeah.
But you, what you've done was you've changed that.
Exactly.
Even though the Hukaf Ladira, you planted inside.
Indeed. Fine. Let's carry
it. Did not.
Not right. The Meir Kodma, then we said in the Mishnah that if the city was there first, Kotzitvein and Nosindam, full of, then you have to chop down your tree that's within the 25 or 50 amas, and the city is not obligated to pay you for it. So, question is, Maishna Gavid Bor, now why is it different? Later on in the Perek, we're going to learn about the case where you have a tree too close to your neighbor's Bor, and we say if the Bor was there first, Kotzitvein and Nosindam, then you have to chop down the tree, but the other guy is obligated to pay you the value of it. Why is it over here? When he chops down the tree, the city is not obligated to pay him for it. Amar Rav Kahana, famous expression, kidra beishut fi lechamim v'le karira. When you have a pot that belongs to a bunch of partners, it's neither hot nor cold because everybody relies on each other. You know? Everybody passes the buck to somebody else. So the same way, why don't we want that we're not going to obligate the residents of the city to pay him, because each one is going to say, well, start with the other guy first, start collecting the money from somebody else, and then it's not going to happen. Meanwhile, you're going to have a gnai to the city. So therefore, you want to get the tree down as soon as possible. Okay, the Gemara says, why Kusha? Why does Rav Kahana even have a question? Dilba shiny hezeka d'rabba mehezeka d'yachid. You could answer very simple. There's a difference in a hezek that applies to all the rabbim, to an entire city, versus the hezek of an individual person with his bur. Maybe the chachamim are not going to obligate you for the sake of one other person's bur to chop down your tree, but they'll obligate you for the sake of a whole city. So no, rather we have to say that this question and answer of Rav Kahana went on the last part of the Mishnah, where the Mishnah continued.
On the Reisha,
you don't need the question, yeah. Where the Mishnah continued, where we said that if the tree was there first, you're still obligated to chop it down. The city has to pay you for it. The question is, why do you have to chop it down first? Why shouldn't he have the ability to say, first pay me for my tree, then I'll chop it down? And there
what's
comes
the difference?
Because Lahora, he could say, if I chop it down now, maybe it might be a while before I get my money or whatever. If you're going to obligate me to chop down my tree, you got to pay me first. And there comes the answer. Because we don't want to wait until they get their act together and pay him, because then everybody's going
to
pass the buck to somebody else.
So he has to chop it down,
and then they're going to pay him because his tree was there first. But therefore, they can obligate him to chop it down now, and the payment we'll deal with afterwards. But because the city belongs to the rabbim,
yeah.
And therefore rabbim against the yachid, it's because the rabbim themselves are not necessarily going to get their act together fast enough to get it done. Meanwhile, you're going to have a gnai to the city. The whole point of removing the tree is to reach noy Eretz Yisrael, for the beauty of Eretz Yisrael. You don't want that should last any longer than necessary. So therefore, let him chop it down right away. And therefore, the fact that he's not going to get paid yet, he's going to have to wait with his payment until they can.
That you're not supposed to chop trees in Eretz Yisrael,
but there are exceptions. This being one of them.
Isn't that the Oraisa? And this is
no, but the Oraisa is loisashchis when you're doing it derech hashvasa, when you're doing it for destructive purpose. This is a constructive purpose.
In Bahar, this is the Oraisa.
Well, the concept of the Migrash, no, but this is what I'm saying, Mishum No Yeretz Yisrael, is not, no, that's not explicit.
Right.
It's not, no, but still, you're allowed to do it for a purpose, and this is for a purpose, this is for a constructive purpose.
The concept is you're doing it for Tashris, that you cannot. So
if you're doing it in Derech HaShchasa, if you're doing it in a destructive way, yeah, that's there, I think. Then we said Sofik Zekodim, Sofik Zekodim, Kotitzvein, and Osindom, and we said that if there's a Sofik, whether the tree or the city was there first, then he has to chop it down, and they're not obligated to pay him. Question is, so why is it different? We say in the later Mishnah that if you have a case of a tree versus a burr, we say that if it's a suffix, which one came first, we don't obligate you to chop down your tree. Why here? We obligate him to chop down his tree. The answer is hasam devade lava mekas koi, because there it's not certain that it has to be cut down. If the guy who has the tree can prove that his tree was there first, he takes a water to cut it down. But my tree was here first. That's the question. Wait. Therefore, if it's a suffix, we can't tell him, you want to tell me, I have to chop down my tree, prove that I'm obligated to.
Mm-hmm.
Here, either way, it's going to be chopped down because you have the problem of Noi Eretz Yisrael. Here you have the problem of here you have the issue of Noi Eretz Yisrael, which is a reason it's going to be chopped down regardless. Therefore, so even if it's a suffix, we tell him, you chop it down, we know for sure it's going to have to be chopped down either way, so you have to do that. What about that you're going to be paid? You want that we should pay you for it. You're the one who's going to have to bring the proof that your tree was here first. So therefore, in the case of the burr, in other words, you have two differences. The case of the burr, if it's a suffix, you're not obligated to chop it down. And either way, whether you're obligated to chop it down or not, well, either way, in any case where you're obligated to chop it down, the other guy is obligated to pay you for it. Here, chopping it down is going to happen regardless. Whether they're obligated to pay you depends on whether the tree was there, was definitely there first. Mishnah says, Marchikinus Gurin Kavuam in Eir. Marchikinus Gurin Kavuam in Eir Chamishamama. It's only in Eretz Yisrael we're talking about. Marchikinus Gurin Kavuam in Eir Chamishamama. You have to keep away a permanent threshing floor from the city 50 amas. Because when you thresh the grain over there, you have the chaff, the seeds, and the residue or whatever that flies away, and therefore it'll damage things in the city. It dries up the seeds. It affects their plowed fields or whatever. So you have to keep it away 50 hours. Lo yasa adam gerdin kavur b'sechalo. It continues the Mishnah. Is not allowed to set up a permanent threshing floor, even on his own property, unless there's 50 amma of clear space on every side. Again, so he doesn't damage other people's property with his chaff. And by the way, even Rabbi Yossi would have to agree to that because of duty delay. It's a case where he's causing the direct hazard. Also, a person has to keep away his garden, his threshing area, from other people's plant, from other people's young trees, and from his plowed field, enough of a distance that he won't cause a hazard. Now, that sounds like less than 50 amos, which leads to the Gemara's question: Maishna Reisha, Maishna Sefer? What's the difference between the Reisha, where we said 50 amos flat, and the Sefer, where we're saying however far you need to not make a hazard, which implies less than 50 amos? I'm going to buy a sefer, so on the Gurun chain of Kavur. So Abaya says you have to say that the sefer is talking about a non-permanent threshing floor. In other words, you have a permanent one. There you need 50 amos. But if it's an ad hoc thing for one time, you're setting up an area to thresh, you don't necessarily need 50 amos. You just need an amount that you can figure that under prevailing conditions, under the current wind conditions or whatever, it's not going to cause damage.
What damage could it cause?
Again, that we said the chaff lands on things and dries them up and over-fertilizes the ground and whatever, yeah.
In other people's fields,
yeah. Okay, hefi domi gerdin ken shein kavua. Fine, what's the definition then for this purpose of a gerdin shein kavua? Amar Rabbi Yosi, b'chan din kol she'ein zoda barachas. If there's so little grain, if it's such a small pile of grain that you don't need a fork, you don't need a pitchfork in order to winnow it. Like this, the usual way of doing a winnowing when you have a lot of grain, you throw it up in the air with a pitchfork, the wind blows away the chaff, the light stuff or whatever, the grain falls down. When you have so little of it that you don't even need that there's little of it enough that you can just put it in a small pile over there, and the wind itself will just come and blow the chaff away. That's considered a Gerdin Shein Kavua. Okay, that's one explanation. Rav Ashi.
Yeah, Gerdin Shein Kavua. What do we need a pitchfork? We could say
that's the point. You don't need a pitchfork.
Three weeks or
no, because that it doesn't go based on how often it is. It depends on how much grain there is. Abaye is arguing, and Rav Yosi ben Chanina is saying that if you have a small enough amount of grain, then you don't even need to throw it up in the air. Therefore, the chances are the chaff is not gonna go very far. Therefore, you don't need 50 amos. Okay, Rav Ashi says here's a different explanation. Matam kamar. No, when we say that you, in the end of the Mishnah, b'chdei shelo yazik, it's not saying a different amount. It's giving a reason. My time of machik and going for woman ir chamish mama. The reason for the 50 amos is k'dei shelo yazik, is in order that it shouldn't cause damage. In other words, according to Rav Ashi, it sounds like not necessarily is there a difference between kavua or ain't a kavua. Some of the Farshim say maybe Rav Ashi would agree with the actual din that ain't a kavua is different, but he would say that's not what the Mishnah means. It's fine, the din may be a din, but that's not what the Mishnah means.
So for him, he would regard it.
Yeah. Yes. Mesa, the Gemara says, I have a contradiction to Abaya. A Braita says, you have to keep a permanent threshing floor 50 amos away from the city. And continues the Braita, just as you have to keep it away 50 amos from the city, so it doesn't damage people's gardens or whatever with the blowing chaff. So also you have to keep it away from the other guy's pumpkins or cucumbers, or his young trees, or from his newly plowed field. Nira means the newly plowed field. Rashi explains that what they would do is sometime during the summer they would plow the field in preparation for later on at the beginning of the fall they're going to start planting in it. But meanwhile they would plant it. They would plow it during the summer to kill any of the weeds, to kill the weeds, the thorns or whatever. So therefore, at that point, afterwards, after it's plowed like that during the summer, if chaff starts landing on it, it's going to, as the Gemara is going to say, it's going to over-fertilize it, kind of. So. And the Mishnah, the Braita finishes off Chamishim Amah Kadesh Shelo Yazik, in order that you don't damage. So Bishleim Lo Rav Ashi Nicha. According to Rav Ashi, it says Chamishim Amah Kadesh Shelo Yazik. Obviously, that's what it means. What does Kadesh Shelo Yazik mean? It means 50 Amah. El Abaya Kasha. But according to Abaya, what would it mean? who says that 50 amos and kadesh lo yazik are two different amounts, what would he say? So Tosfos answers. Tosfos points out, by the way, even Abaya might have agreed with Rav Ashi's understanding of the Mishnah, except that he figured that why would the Mishnah have to tell us kadesh lo yazik? But once we see that the Braisa, all these things are kadesh lo yazik. Once we see that the Braisa spells out kadesh lo yazik, then it's logical to assume that the Mishnah also means the same thing, that it's giving a reason. In that case, how would Abaya understand it? The answer is kasha. Okay, it's a kasha and Abaya.
No answer.
Again, kasha doesn't mean we've completely shlugged them up. Definitively, but at least okay. Now, going back to the Braisa, I mentioned four things that you have to keep away your chaff from. The first two are mikshuav and midluav, from his pumpkins or his cucumbers. I can understand why you have to keep
pumpkins hard.
No, the point is although avka v'asibalibe, because the dust, the chaff, goes and gets into the heart of the plant while it's growing. In other words, the stuff gets into the growing cucumber or pumpkin or whatever, or metzavile, and it dries it up. So I can understand why that would be a problem. Elmi nirei amai, why should he have to keep it away from his plowed field? What's wrong with chaff landing on a plowed field?
It's going to grow.
Because it makes it more fertilizer. So therefore, so Rashi explains, in other words, later on when you plant it, that so Rashi explains, Tosfos says similar, that the point is fertilizer is good for a field, obviously, but too much is no good. It drains, it burns, Rashi says, the seeds. Yeah, it destroys them, basically. Yeah, so therefore, so that would be a problem. Mishnah says, more things that have to be kept away from a city. You have to keep away dead animals and graves. And a burski is a tannery. All of those have to be kept away 50 amos away from the city because of the bad smell. Before I should give a different reason why basic quarters have to be 50 amos away. What if the graves are deep and there's no smell? Nevertheless, though, you don't want people walk out of the city every time and find the graves over there and then get depressed. There's a time and place for avelus, but not all the time.
So
50 amos. 50 amos.
So what difference makes 50 amos? You can still see them.
You can see them, but it's not as obtrusive. It's not on top of you.
50 amos is what?
50 amos is about 75, 80 feet. They have the graveyard next to them. Yeah, yeah. So we're saying not to do that.
That's interesting. What kind of an idea they get to do that?
Whatever. I'll tell you an interesting thing from my own family history. My ancestors come from a little town in Germany called Eichtersheim. Yeah, it's a little town in southern Germany, about an hour and a half drive south of Frankfurt. So their Beis HaKvaris, their local little Beis HaKvaris, is a little bit of a distance outside the city. And if you look, I once looked when I was planning to visit there years ago to visit my ancestors' Kvarim, I looked on the city website, and they write over there that, yes, they put the Jewish community put it outside the city on the basis of this Mishnah. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I have to check my family.
All right. Continues the Mishnah. Ein oisin burski elo l'mizrach ha'ir. You're only allowed to, if you're putting up a tannery, you're only allowed to put it on the east side of the city. Rashi says the reason is because the east wind, we're talking in Yisrael and Babel and that climatic area, the east wind is not usually a strong wind. When it's a stormy wind, then it comes strongly, but normally it's not just a strong wind, so therefore it's not going to bring the smell as badly to the city.
West wing is much.
So Tosfos learns the other way around. Tosfos learns the reason is the west wind is extremely strong, and therefore that'll blow the smell of the tannery away from the city. That's how Tosfos learns, yeah. Okay. Rabbi Akiva says, no, you can make a tannery on any side of the city you want, except for the west, for reasons which we'll talk about in the Gemara. And you have to keep it 50 amos away. Which, what does that mean? Does he mean 50 amos away in every direction, but not at all on the west? Or does he mean 50 amos on the west and closer in any direction? Well, the Gemara will take that up. Also, umachikinas hamishrim in a yerek, we learned this before in the perek, you have to keep away, if you have a pit for soaking flax, you have to keep that away a certain distance from the other guy's from the other guy's vegetables because the foul water over there is going to have an effect, is going to have a bad effect on his vegetables. Yeah. That's a creation min habitzolim. And if you're growing leeks in your field, you have to keep them away from the other guy's field of onions because they weaken the pungency of the onions. That's chardom min advodim. And if you have mustard plants, you have to keep them away from the other guy's bees. But Rav Yosi, Master Bechado, Rav Yosi says that you're allowed to have mustard plants near the bees. We talked about it earlier in the Perek. The Gemara will take it up briefly at the end of our Gemara.
The bees don't like something that's bitter.
No, so we said they will try it, but then they go away. But meanwhile, it caused damage to their honey, or it caused damage to the plants. That's what we learned at the beginning of the Perek when we discussed this. We said that the Chachamim argue that it's a one way hezek, that the mustard causes damage to the bees' honey because they end up eating their own honey, or it ends up getting an off taste or whatever. And Rav Yosi argued that it's a two-way hezek, and therefore one of them can't require the other one to distance himself any more than he can require himself to distance himself. So Gemara says, Rav Akiva Heichi Kama. What does Rav Akiva mean in the Braisa when he says that you can make a burski on any side of the city except the west, but 50 amas away? Does he mean any other side of the city? You could put it even close to the city, except for the west, where you have to keep it 50 amas away. If you want to put it any other side of the city, it has to be 50 amas away. Except for the west side, where you're not allowed to put a burski at all. Okay, Tashma, the Tanya, Rabbi Akiva, Oma, L'chol ruach o'oseh o'macha chamishim amma, you can make it in any direction as long as it's 50 amas away. Chutz mima rabba deina o'oseh kol ikar, except for the west, which you can't do it at all. So like you said, mipneshi tibira, because the west is constant. Now, what do you mean constant? What does that mean? Amalei rabba l'rabba nachman, mai tibira. What do you mean constant? Ilema tibira beruchoy, do you mean that the west wind is constantly blowing? No. V'ha amar av chonan bar abba, amar rab, no. Dalad ruchas menashvis b'cholyam. There are four different winds that blow every day, different times of the day, different winds.
We're talking
primarily about Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, yeah. Four winds blow every day, in other words, from each of the different directions. V'ruach tzfonis im kulon. Every one of them, there's always a northern wind blowing with them, because Rashi says, based on a Gemara in Yevamos, the north wind is soft and gentle, and then moderates things. If it weren't for the ruach tzfonis always being together with the other winds, the world wouldn't be able to exist because the whatever climate the other winds bring would be too strong. So the north wind moderates it. So we see the north wind is the constant one. And the Braisa continues, v'ruach droimis kasha mikolon, the south wind is the harshest of all of them.
Oh, yeah.
In Eretz Yisrael, again, it comes from the Negev,
right.
Yeah. The umolad ben netz shemamida, and if it were not for ben netz, netz literally means is a type of bird of prey, or a sparrow hawk or something like that.
Hawk, sparrow hawk, whatever.
Ben netz is a malach shaped like that, a malach who has the form of a net. So if it weren't for him, shemamida, that he holds back the south wind with his wings, machrevas es ha'olam, then the south wind would destroy the world. That's how harsh it is. And you have a pasuk in Eiyav that expresses this. The Eibishter tells Eiyav, part of all the challenges that he says to Eiyav, do you understand how I run the world? That we learned in Perek Aleph. He says to him, is it through your understanding that the net, is it from your understanding that the net, this is the Eibishter talking to Eiyav, saying, do you begin to understand how I work the world? Is it through your understanding that the net gains its wings, has its feathers? Yifris Knuffa will say, and he spreads his wings towards the south. No, so the answer that we see from that the net spreads his wings towards the south and holds back the south wind. So anyway, the point is that we see that the Tadir, the wind that's constant, is the north wind. So what would we mean Tadira? Elamai Tadira Tadira B'Shchina. No, rather, what do we mean constant? We mean that the west side is the constant place of the Shchina.
I thought the Shechina was on the east.
Wait. We should come, we should give credit to our ancestors, to the Anshik Nesagdola, for telling us the following pasuk, Shodiyu Mokum Tvila. They informed us what the right direction to daven in. which direction the Shechina is in. Namely, that you have the positive, we say it every day in davening, the hosts of the heaven, the sun and the moon and so forth, bow to you. Now, what does it mean, bow to you? The fact that they travel on the sky from east to west is considered, if we say that the Shechina is in the west, it's like they're coming and bowing, so like they come up to the middle of the sky and they start descending in the sky towards the west. Like they're coming and bowing to the west towards the Shechina.
From the east to the west?
They come from the east and they start going up in the sky until they reach their highest point in the sky for the day.
Right.
Then they start descending toward the west, and at descending is like bowing down. They're bowing down towards the Shechina, which is in the west. So one of the
excellent bubbles, they all down into the west.
Well, we'll see that later. We'll see that at the end of the Gemara, yeah. But anyway, what does this mean? Bodo v'nasa tovel avitzein. One of the explanations is, if it weren't for that positive, we would think, can you say the Shechina is anywhere? The Gemara itself is going to talk about another opinion that the Shechina is everywhere. The fact that we should give credit to the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, they told us this positive. They said that we're able to think of it in terms of the Shechina being in the west.
By following the
fact that the sun and whatever go in that direction.
If the sun ever goes the other way.
Yeah. Tosfos, by the way, talks about, I mean, you could say that on a different basis. You could say, in the Beis Mikdash, where was the Kodesh HaKadoshim? On the west side of the Hefer. So Tosfos says, okay, but the fact of the matter is that has to be in some direction. It may have been in the west.
Say that
no,
but it's not on the east because Brimen Avei Dezara?
That's the Gemara is going to take that up in a minute, yeah. Wait. Anyway, Tosfos says another point is, yes, the Kodesh HaKadoshim was in the west side of the Heichal, but the Oren itself was on the east side of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So from that alone, you wouldn't have a proof that Shechina b'Mayim. But from the fact, the way the sun and the moon and the stars go, that you have a proof. But the Alter Rebbe talks about this in Tanya, by the way, that this is why in davening, before Shemini Esrei, we talk about the brachos of Shema, we talk about the movements of the heavenly bodies and whatever. One idea that he says, imagine you come to a place, you come to a palace, you don't know who the king is, but you see somebody who all the great ministers and whatever bow before him, you realize who's the king, and you have a pachad of him. The same way, when we consider how the sun and the moon and the stars and so forth are all bowing towards the west, it makes us realize, it makes us get some idea of the greatness of Hashem. Which is and the frame of mind to go into saying Shema and Shemoneh Esrei. Maskev for Rav Acha bar Yaakov, however, Rav Acha bar Yaakov asks on that. Why? Who says that the fact that the heavenly bodies move toward the west shows that the Shechina is in the west? The Dilma ke'evet shenoto pras merabe. Maybe rather they're acting like a servant who received a gift from his master. V'chozel achor of a mishnachbe. And then he walks backwards and bows. So if I can't, maybe the Shechina is in the east. And therefore, in other words, so you have the heavenly bodies, like they're backing away from the east and then going down. Akasha, okay, Akasha. Marsha talks about, by the way, that part of what the Gemara is asking over here is we know all the heavenly bodies have really, there's two different motions that we can talk of. There's the actual motion of the thing itself that moves from west to east. You can see it more easily with the moon because it moves faster, but you can see it in a lesser way with the other one. And then you have the fact that daily they rotate. Daily they rotate from east to west. Not in terms of because of the rotation of the earth, in terms of the physics of the physics that the Gemara and the Rambam talk about it, that there's a Gaugel HaYomi, there's a big sphere outside all the other ones that turns them. Like a set of gears that lock together.
What that turns the whole.
If you look at the Rambam in Hilchos Yisodei
HaTorah,
and then there's the Gagal Yomi that turns all of them in the opposite direction.
Right.
If you look in the Rambam in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, he describes it in detail. He explains each of the planets has its own Gagal, its own sphere, which turns from west to east a certain amount per day. Different heavenly bodies have different amounts that they turn. But then you have outside of that is a Gagal Yomi, which is like a one larger thing that turns all of them in the opposite direction. So the sun, let's say, for example, again, looking at it from our point of view on Earth, the sun, let's say, for example, moves about 1 degree every day from west to east. At the same time, though, every 24 hours, it's moving in the sky 360 degrees from east to west. So therefore, every day, in other words, every day it completes 359 degrees. So therefore, so Marshall talks about that's part of what the Gemara is asking over here. Who says the daily motion is considered the important thing for this purpose? Maybe the proper motion, the west to east motion, is considered the important thing. And that's the Gemara's Kasha. Okay. Kasha.
Well, how should we look at
it? We should look at it that the Gemara is talking in, first of all, the Gemara is talking to a certain extent in metaphors, but second of all, the Gemara is also talking in terms of how we on Earth see it. We see the Eved to set up things. The Eved didn't have to make the Earth rotate, after all. The fact that he made it rotate, and then he made it rotate in a certain direction, so that everything in the sky appears to move from east to west, is meant for us to understand that it means that the Shechina is in the west, and that they're all bowing to the Shechina, and therefore to understand from that the greatness of Ein Shtei. Doesn't mean in terms of actual physics, is it necessarily so? Maybe not. But in terms of how we see it,
if we see the sun rotating from east to west, that means to say that the
other is bowing toward the west. Fine. But the Earth itself is staying in one place. It's not actually moving in any. It's moved. That's a different motion. But that we can't talk about whether it's moving east or west. That's all motion in space is relative.
Moving west to east.
We're not talking about the rotation of the Earth around its axis. We're talking about
it's rotating.
Fine, but again, we're talking about it from the point of view of us on Earth, how we look at it. And you have the famous letter from the Rebbe where he points out, based on the theory of relativity, all motion in space is relative. You can't really talk about any more that the Earth is moving around the Sun versus the Sun moving around the Earth. Each of them is moving. Yeah. It all depends on your frame of reference. Yeah. Okay. The Gemara says now.
So then it goes against this Gemara.
No, but from our frame of reference, that's how it is. From our frame of reference, that's how the Eibush put us in this world. The Eibush didn't put us on another planet.
Because we get the Goyim, I think that they're so smart that the Gemara is wrong.
However, Rav Oshia saw the Shechina b'chomakim. However, Rav Oshia holds that the Shechina is everywhere. There's no direction that you can say that the Shechina is more in one place than another. Da'am Rav Oshia, my dichtiv, what do you have another pasuk in that same context that says the previous pasuk, actually, it's actually the beginning of the same pasuk. Ata Hashem l'vadecha, you Hashem are alone, are the only one. Ata asiteh ha'shamayim v'gomim, you made the heavens, etc. We say it every day, yeah. What do you mean, Ata Hashem l'vadecha? What do you mean, unique? And we're talking in connection with the Tzva Shemayim, we're talking about in connection with the hosts of heaven. What's the connection? It means, he says, Shluchacha loike shluchid basav adam. The shluchim of the Eveshter are not like the shluchim of a human being. Shluchid basav adam l'makim shemishtalchim l'sham machzirim shlichusam. When you send the shliach, he leaves from where you are, and when he returns to give his report, he has to return to where you are. He has to return to the same place where you sent him out from. Your shluchim, because the Shechina is everywhere, we're saying to the Eibishter, therefore, where they go, from there they're able to give their report. Because the Shechina is equally there as where they came from. And therefore they can give their report wherever they are. Because the Shechina is everywhere. Shenema, you have another pasuk in Iyov, Hashalach Brokim B'Yelech, or another pasuk the Eibishter says to Iyov, can you send out the lightnings and they will go? V'yomru l'cha hinenu, and they will tell you, they will go, and they will tell you, here we are. Now, it doesn't say they will come back and report we accomplished what we were supposed to do. But they go, and then they say. In other words, they go from here to there, and then they report from here. Therefore, we see the Shechina is everywhere. That's where Rav Oshia holds that. But after the
Shechina,
since we're saying they don't have to come back to report,
because
the Shechina is everywhere. But after Rabbi Shmuel saw the Shechina b'chol makom, also Rabbi Shmuel is another opinion who holds the Shechina is everywhere. The Tana of Rabbi Shmuel, minayin sheshechina b'chol makom shenema. You have another pasuk that says, Zechariah says, hinei ha'malach ha'dover b'yotze, behold, the malach who was speaking to me goes and leaves. U'malach ha'cha yotze l'krosei, and another malach is going out opposite him.
So the Shechina was on top of.
There's different levels. Obviously, we're talking about the different levels of the Shechina, which are obviously right. We have a particular Dilu Shechina in certain places. When there's 10 Jews together, there's a certain level of Dilu
Shechina. The Shechina was somewhere.
Yeah, fine. But we're saying, as a general thing, Rabbi Akiva is saying, like, by default, the Shechina is in the West. And Rabbi Oshi is saying, by default, there's no specific place that you can say the Shechina is more than others.
Did you see anything from the Tanakh Tzedek or anything on this tomorrow?
I didn't have a chance to look, actually. Why he said something on it?
No, I assume that you look up all
I do try to look up, but I didn't have as much time to as I wanted.
Well,
so.
You also have tomorrow.
Yeah, there's that, yeah. Okay. So, Shenema, Hinei HaMalach HaDover B'Yotze, behold, the Malach who was speaking to me goes out. U'Malach HaCha Yotze L'Krosein, another Malach goes out to it opposite him. Now, Achrav Leinemar, it doesn't say he's going out after him, as if they're all coming from the same place. Ella Likrosse, but he's coming out towards him. Malamar Shechina B'chol Makom. So like you have, so to speak, the first Malach is coming from here and then leaving, and the second Malach, he's leaving back to where he's supposed to be. And another Malach is coming out. Another Malach is coming out, Likrosse, opposite him, meaning from here. So like the first Malach, so to speak, was being sent by the Eveshter from here. The other one is being sent from here. So we see the Shechina is equally everywhere. We also see that Rav Sheshet holds that the Shechinah is everywhere. Because we see that Rav Sheshet, who was blind, tells his Mishores, when it comes time for me to daven Shemana Esrei, set me up facing in any direction, levar mi mizrach, except for facing east. V'lav mishum de'les v'shchina. Now, not to say because the Shechina is not just as much in the east as everywhere. El mishum de'moru b'mini, but because the minim make a big deal of davening to the east because they want to daven towards the sun. Nowadays, we don't have people davening towards the sun, and practically speaking, we daven towards the east. So Tosfos points out, actually, we're going to see in this sugya, we have three different opinions. Again, we have Rabbi Akiva saying that the Shechina is to the west, and therefore it would be appropriate to daven to the west. We have Rav Sheshet and these other opinions who said that Shechina is everywhere and therefore you can daven in any direction. Then you have a third opinion, which the Gemara is going to take up near the end, which said, based on the Gemara and Brachas, that says you should be davening in the direction of Yerushalayim, which is what we do.
Why? Because the Shechina is...
Because we're davening towards the Beis Hamikdash. To a certain extent, the Shechina is still there. Yeah. The Rambam, right? For example, that the...
For example,
the Rambam writes that this is why we're not allowed to go into the Hadabayis nowadays, since we're Tomei, because it still has Kedusha. The Kedusha has still remain. The Shechina is still there.
So, yeah, you could say the Shechina is everywhere, but it's greater than you.
But it's greater in your shrine, yeah. Okay, but according to the first two opinions of it here, it comes out from Tosfos that it wouldn't matter. You would dab it in the direction of the Shechina, which is to the west or in any direction, as the case may be. According to the opinions over here, the halacha is, like the opinion in Brachas and like the opinion that we're going to have at the end of the Gemara over here, that you have to dab it in the direction of Yerushalayim, unless you don't know which direction is Yerushalayim, and then yeah. What were you going
to say? So you could dab in two directions. Yeah, right, it wasn't work.
Yeah, but you're dabbing in the... Yeah,
oh, there you go.
Yeah, okay.
Any direction you dab in, eventually it's going to get to the right...
Actually, you know, our Gemara later on, well, I guess we'll see if we can get to it tonight, but our Gemara later on talks about the famous thing that if you want to become rich, you should daven a little bit to the north, and if you want to become smart, you should daven a little bit towards the south, Shulchan Badorim, Shulchan Batsokan, and Menor Badorim. Later on in our Gemara, we'll see if we can get to it tonight. In Sephardic Siddur, it tells a story about a chassid of the Mezuzah Magid who starts becoming poor. And before he had been rich, now he starts learning about the Maggid, he becomes a chassid of his, and now he starts losing his wealth. So he comes to the Maggid. The Maggid tells him, okay, look, you have this Gemara over here. If you want to, you know, north versus south. Now let me ask you, so what happens if a person wants to be both smart and rich? You can't take both north or south.
Yeah, one time you north, one time you south.
So the Maggid answers him, a person has to have bittul. A person has to be humble. And when you have bittul, when you don't take up any space in your own mind, then you can be both north and south. So the guy got the hint, in other words, that he needs a little bittul. Okay, going back to Rabbo Amar Shechina B'Mayer. Yet another opinion. We said before that Rabbi Akiva holds that the Shechina is primarily in the west. Rabbo also holds that way. The Amar Rabbo, my Uria Avir Yudke. Why is the direction called Uria? Now, what is Uria? Rashi gives two explanations. One is that in Persian, Uria means the west. So therefore, it's called that because Avir Yudke, it's the space of Yudke, of the H. The second explanation actually says is the word Uria is like the word Orient in English from Latin.
Huh.
It means the east. So therefore, why do they call that direction Orient? Why do they call the east Orient? Because if the Shechina is in the west, then it means the east is like the open area facing the Shechina, so to speak. So even the Goyim who came up with the Latin language or whatever, they still subconsciously they understood this idea. Amar Rav Yehuda. Since we're talking about the different directions and the different winds that come from them, my dichtiv, what does it mean? It says in the pasuk at the beginning of Hazinu, Yarif the pasuk has four parts over there. Yarif kamata, Moshe Rabbeinu says about what he's going to teach the Jewish people. Yarif kamata lichi, tizau katali mirasi, kisirim ale desha, v'chirubihim ale esa. We're going to direction each one of those as talking about the winds and the rain that comes from a different direction, which Moshe is comparing his Torah to. We'll stop soon, I guess. Yeah. So, Yarif Kamot Lichi refers to Zuma Ruach Ma'arabis. This refers to the west wind.
Yarif
Kamot. The simple meaning of Yarif means it'll drip, but it'll drip. But the Gemara is going to dash in Yarif Meloshin Odif, Meloshin the back. So therefore, Yarif, and actually, by the way, explains the point of this is Moshe is comparing the Torah to the four winds of the world, to the four directions, the four winds. Just as the world needs all four winds in order to keep on existing, so the world needs the Torah in order to keep on existing. So Yarif Kamotalit, Chizuruach Ma'arabis, Shabbat Me'orpe Shaloylam. This refers to the west wind, which comes from the Oref of the world. What is the Oref? Rashi says two possibilities. One is it means, Rashi's first explanation is that Oref means the strength of the world. Again, if we say Shechinah B'Mayrev, then that's the strongest part of the world. The second possibility, Rashi says, is that usually directions in Tanakh are given in terms of a person facing east. In other languages also, that's where we get the word orient from. Is when a person is oriented, means they're facing east. So the west is the back, is where the back of the neck is.
True, it's the strongest part even today.
Okay. So those are the two reasons why it can be called Orpah Shalom. So that's Yarif Kamotalitri, therefore refers to the west wind. Tizar Katalim Yot. See, next when he continues, let my saying flow like the dew. Zuruach Tzfonis Shemazela Tzazahan. This refers to the north wind, which causes gold to flow. Why is that? Rashi says, because the north wind warms up the world. And therefore, it causes famine, and therefore people end up having to spend a lot of money. Some of them are from answer. That's not really that it makes the. Not so much that it makes it warm, but it clears away the clouds. The north wind. The north wind clears away the clouds, so there's less rain. Less rain means there's a drought. Right. Drought means higher prices. V'cheinu omer hazolim zohav mikis, and thus we see that the word zol can be applied to gold. A pasuk in Yeshaya that mentions people who let gold flow from their pockets. They were talking about that they spend money to make up a desires, but the point is we see that the expression zol can refer to gold. Kisirim aledesha, the third part of the pasuk in Hazinu, kisirim aledesha, zuruach mizrachis, this refers to the east wind, shemas eres, it's called olam kisarir, which storms up the whole world like a shed. So like we said at the top of the Amud, Rashi says the east wind is usually a gentle wind, but sometimes it becomes harsh and strong, and then it brings tremendous storms. And then when it finishes off, that Moshe says that like drippings on the grass, zuruach droimis, this means the south wind, she malu revivu magadel hasavim, which brings rain and causes the grass to grow. So we see that Moshe has compared the Torah to all
the
four
south
winds.
Wind?
The south wind is the one that brings rain.
Before that the south wind brings.
We said before that the south wind. No, we said before the south wind is a very harsh wind, and if it weren't for that, it would destroy the world. But maybe with too much rain.
So how can it be very harsh and bring rain?
When it's gentle, it brings rain.
We were just assuming since it was there since well that it was a hot wind.
Yeah.
Apparently it's from what we were assuming.
Well, no, because it could also be. I mean, you do have the negative south of Eretz Yisrael, but south of that, you also have the Red Sea or whatever. It could be bringing moisture from there. Yeah. I don't know.
Usually what brings rain is from the Mediterranean.
So we started by saying Yarif Kamoto Lichri. We mentioned Motor. So yeah, apparently two of these winds bring
south
rain. The south and west. Yeah, but we're saying Revivim means like gentle showers, sort of. So yeah, I guess that's... Revivim is what we're associating with the south. Revivim means more like gentle showers.
It's more gentle than the west.
So therefore, Magadol Tasavim, that's what makes the grass grow, because the Gemara tells us in Tainis that primarily light showers are what helps the grass grow, and heavy rains are what help the trees grow.
In Tel Aviv, you have a much stronger wind than in Eilat. You have a soft wind.
Same idea, I guess. Tanya, Rabbi Eliezer, Olam Achsadra Hujoyna. The world is like an Achsadra. An Achsadra, we learned before, is an area that's closed in on three sides and open on the fourth side. V'ruach Tzfonis Enim Mesebevis. The fourth side, the north side, is not surrounded with a wall. Now, the straightforward meaning, the surface meaning of the Gemara that we're going to say over here is the surface meaning of what we're talking about over here is the Gemara is sounds like it's saying that the earth is flat. Yeah. You have a sky around it, and then there's no rakia on the fourth side. Let's first learn the actual words, and then we'll talk about what a number of different Mephoshim talk about the ideas behind it. Yeah, so Ruach Tzfonis Enim Mesebevis, the fourth side is not surrounded by a wall. The Kivanshi Giachama Eitzo Keren Ma'arav Tzfonis. So the sun circles around during the day. It goes from east to south to west. Then when it gets to the northwestern corner, where does it go? Nichtefes va'olah l'mayla min arakia. Then it curves and goes above the rakia. In other words, because if it went on this side, the idea would be there's no rakia over there. Where would it go? So therefore, Rabbi Eliezer is saying it goes. The sun goes like this every day. He's saying. again, wait, and we'll talk about what all this means. Rabbi Yeshua says, no, the world is like a tent where it's completely surrounded on all sides. The north side is surrounded. It has Rakia just like the other side. So why don't we see the sun when it's on the north? Because when the sun reaches the northwest corner over here, it goes behind the vault of the Rakia, and therefore it's invisible.
Wait.
One second. As it says in the Pasuk, the Pasuk says in Kehelis, the sun goes to the south, the Soviv al-Safan and circles around to the north. So what's the difference in Holech and Soviv? The difference is Holech is when we see it, and Soviv is when it's not. And the Pasuk continues, so therefore, Holech al-Dorim, it goes to the south, is by day. The Soviv al-Safan, it turns around to the north, is by Laila, is at night. We don't see it. It's Soviv because it's behind the Rakia. The puzzle continues, Soviv, Soviv, Holech HaRuach, it round and round the direction it goes, Val Srivois of Shav HaRuach, and all around it comes back. Elu Pnei Mizrach, Pnei Meirav, this refers to the east and the west. The sun, during the winter, the sun rises in the southeast and sets in the southwest. So therefore, most of the east and most of the west, the sun is also out of view. According to Rabbi Yeshua's way of looking at it, it's behind the Rakia at that point. So therefore, it's Mesabab sun. It's surrounding it, but not within our view.
It rises
in the southeast and sets in the southwest. So therefore, at a time like that, during the winter, according to Rabbi Yeshua, you would have it within the Rakia. It's between the Rakia and us from here to here. Then it goes behind the Rakia from here to here. So most of the west and all of the north and most of the east, it's Mesabab. It's going around without us seeing it. But sometimes it travels them in a way that we see, because during the summer it rises in the northeast, that's in the northwest. So therefore, it goes in the visible part of the east and the south and the west, and it's only the north where we don't see.
And that's of course assuming it's a plan.
Okay. So now is the time to talk about what does all this mean. So first of all, we'll start with the Maharal says we're not talking about the physical Rakia over here. There was a fellow in the Maharal's time named Rabbi Azariah min HaDovim, Rabbi Azariah de Rossi. You can find about him in Wikipedia and other places. He wrote a book called Ma'orei Naim, where he was a frum yid, but his shtickle maskil. He argued that there's a lot the Chachamim didn't know. He argued there's a lot of the sciences and whatever that the Chachamim didn't know, which now, he's living in the 1500s, we know much better than that. The Maharal went ballistic about that. So he wrote an entire sefer called Be'er HaGoyla to argue against this and to point out that to explain that the Rabbi Azariah doesn't know what he's talking about. He comes to this Gemara over here. He said, Maharal says, we're not talking about the physical Rakia. Rakia over here, he says, means there's a Gashmiistic world down here. There's Ruchniistic worlds up there. There's a Rakia that divides them. In Ma'aseh Bereishis, the Hebrew puts the Rakia between the earth and the Shemayim. The Gemara is saying the earth being a physical creation is not a complete thing. The Eibush did not, so to speak, did not create it complete, because if it was complete, it would be ruchniistic. Therefore, in those terms, we're talking the Safa in the north side, which is the north. Again, if you're facing towards the east, then the north is on your left. Therefore, north represents the left. The left is the weaker side. Therefore, in those terms, we can talk about it. If you're talking about that the earth, that the world, the physical world we know of, is incomplete, the logical thing to say is that part that's incomplete is the north, and therefore we say that Ruach Tzvonis Einim Mitzvonis, that the north side does not have that Rakia, does not have that proper division between Gashmius and Ruchnius that's supposed to be there.
Because, in other words,
it's reflecting the idea that our world is an incomplete world. There's actually, by the way, there's a medrash someplace else that says something slightly similar. It says why is the north side created incomplete? According to Rabbi Eliezer, because this way, if a person ever tries to claim I'm a god, I could create the world too, we tell him, fine, never mind creating a world. Start by closing up the north side. Let's see if you can do that. Then we'll see what else you can do.
How would you close the north side?
Whatever it is. According to Maharal, you can't even, because we're talking about the division between Gashmias and Ruchnias. It's not something that. There's a lot of other, in Chassidus it talks about, there's a short mimer in the Kutei Torah where the Alter Rebbe talks about this. He says, the idea is, basically he develops the idea, the south is more associated with Chesed, but therefore there's greater heat over there.
Yeah.
In Parshasazria, quoting all Gemara. The south is more associated with Chesed, but therefore you have the intensity because for one thing, because towards the right again when you're facing east, then the south is to your right. But therefore you have it's more comfortable to live in for one thing. But on the other hand, the sun is intensely hot over there because you also have Chesed mixed together with Gvura. There always has to be there. Always has to be balanced out. The north is associated more with Gvura. Therefore, Ruach Tzvain is Enim Sebeves, because if you had a division over there, if you had a Rakia blocking off Ruchnius on that side, then it would be completely overwhelmed by Gvura. And therefore, and we can't have that. There has to be the balance of Chesed over there. There has to be the balance between Chesed and Gvura over there.
So it has to be open.
So therefore, it has to be open, according to Rabbi Eliezer, anyway. I saw an interesting... there's a lot of other interesting explanations to talk about. I saw one interesting explanation that somebody wanted to give online, that somebody gave online, that maybe what he means is like this. In the north, practically speaking, yes, the sun shines over there, but you don't really get much of the sun's heat because it goes through such a thick amount of atmosphere. You could effectively say that the effects of the sun are basically up in the atmosphere; they don't really come down to earth, as opposed to in the rest of the world where they do. Whereas Rabbi Yeshua would answer to that. Yeah, Rabbi Yeshua would answer to that. Fair enough. Nevertheless, though, you do have a certain amount of it, of the sun's heat and whatever its effects do come down to earth over there. And the fact is, sometimes you have warmer winds come from that part of the world. You don't always have cold winds coming from there because he says ultimately you do have that it's not all of what the sun accomplishes on earth is all above up in the atmosphere up in the north. No, some of it does actually come down to earth.
Is that the north and south parts are cold and the middle parts.
We're talking from the point of view of the northern hemisphere because that's where civilization was in those days, that's where the Eretz Yisrael is, that's where the Torah was given, etc. So we're not talking b'chlal about the southern hemisphere. In general and in Torah when we talk about geography and whatever, we're talking strictly the northern hemisphere. One other thing to mention, by the way, the Ramchal has a long discussion about this in his Piddush on the Siddur, in a couple of other places. He says, b'chlal, the Chachamim want to teach us deeper ideas. For example, this idea of the Maharal is about the division between Gashmius and Ruchnius, this idea of the Alter Rebbe about Chesed versus Gvura, whatever. They have to put it in terms that are familiar to people of their times. People in their times are not familiar with the concept of the earth being round and space being infinite and so forth. They have to put it in terms which people are familiar with, and therefore people in their times were familiar with that the earth is flat and the heavens are round. So in other words, according to the Ramchal, if the Chachamim were expressing it nowadays, they would express it using science, using modern science, using present day science, and they would express it in some other terms.
Way of science,
so that's the thing. It's meant to represent ideas in Ruchnius, but therefore they put it into terms that would be comprehensible to people of their time. All right, let's continue a little bit. Hu haya omer, continues the Braisa. He used to say, and the Gemara interjects to say that the he ason Rabbi Eliezer. This goes back to Rabbi Eliezer. We're now going to continue with Rabbi Eliezer. Again, we had Rabbi Eliezer's opinion that the north side is not closed in. We have Rabbi Yeshua's opinion that it is. Now we're turning to Rabbi Eliezer. He says like this, min acheder tovay sofa, when the another pasuk in Iyov that says from the cheder, from the chamber comes the storm wind. Zuruach dremis, this refers to the south. This refers to the south, which can be considered the chamber, because if the north end is open, then the southern end is like the furthest in, sort of.
Mm-hmm. And why should it come from the south?
So because that's how it is. Min tovay sofa, storms come from the south. According to him, the fact is we see that the southern winds bring storms and rain, like we said before. Revivid. Mizorim kara. The pasuk continues that from Mizorim comes the cold. Zuruach tzvonis. This refers to the north side. Tosis explains Mizorim comes from a word that means like thrown away. So like, so to speak, there should be a wall over there. There should be a mechitza, but it's thrown away. It's removed. The Eved didn't put it over there. Therefore, it can be called Mizorim.
That's what? The north?
That's the north. Minishmas keil yitim kerach. The pasuk continues, from the breath of Hashem, he gives forth. Zuruach ma'arovis. This refers to the southern wind. This refers to the west wind. V'roich of mayim b'mutzak. And there's a large amount of water that's poured out. Zuruach mizrachis. This means the east wind. The Gemara says, "Well, I'm a ma'ar ruach d'roim is ma'al reviver magadel hasavim." Didn't we say before that it's the south wind that brings the showers and makes the grass grow, not the east? The answer is lekasha hada askim mitru benichusa habish fichusa. It depends whether we're talking about a gentle rain or pouring rain. A gentle rain comes from the south. Pouring rain, when it comes from the east. I think maybe we'll continue tomorrow. Yeah.